You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Now, I want to get back to Osama because this ties into what we're talking about. When you mentioned, and I was going to do that before, when he climbed up in a tree, I was laughing at this because I never had this image of Osama. I read that passage about getting his mom's permission, and then on page 117, talking about his success as a battlefield commander, or at least in planning his operation to finally make his one attack, it says, "One intrepid American-born jihadi, Abu Rida, drove his own car from the city and found the gathering column by asking a mule driver where to find Osama bin Laden." And on page 118, you're talking about how he took cover behind a rock and froze, as you mentioned before. And then again, on page 121, which you had mentioned, that he had climbed up in a tree. You say here on page 121, "Osama had blundered to within 100 yards of a Russian scout team. For some unknown reason, Osama climbed a tree. Something that, despite what one sees in John Wayne movies, is almost instantly fatal in combat." You mentioned that, of course. My question is that if this guy is such a Don Knotts character, which apparently he was, how could he have pulled off 9/11? And on page 159, you say that after 10 years of flawless tradecraft, Al-Qaeda's internal communication system was laid open to American intelligence. On page 174, you reiterate that again, and you say that, but Al-Qaeda had gone 10 years without mistakes. How could Al-Qaeda be such a flawless operation when being led by such a character as Osama bin Laden, who faints, who climbs up trees, who hides behind rocks and freezes, who allows somebody to ask a mule driver to find out where he is?
Those things all occurred while Osama was attempting to be an on-the-ground tactical commander. He was able to survive that tree-climbing incident that turned into be a contact with probably a 100- or 200-man Russian infantry probe. Other commanders, Al-Qaeda commanders, more seasoned jihadis, were able to converge on his position. They were able to fight back against the Russians. Osama survived that, but instead of being just some kind of knucklehead, when you survive it and you're the guy with $10 million in the bank, everyone praised him. His fainting on the battlefield was instantly transformed into him just being so calm he could take a nap, etc., etc. He was then pulled back off the line. People around him realized that his money was more important than anything. It was right about this time that Ayman Zawahiri was able to influence bin Laden to focus his attention outward and away from Afghanistan and to start to consider waging jihad against the West. Ayman Zawahiri himself is not someone who could move easily in Western circles, although he does read and speak English. He is a fervent Islamicist. He prays five times a day. He affects a turban. He cultivates a prayer callus on his forehead. He looks like the picture postcard of a wild-eyed Islamic terrorist.
Right.
They were both able to cultivate and procure the services of someone who was much more dangerous than they were. That person was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was from Balochistan, Pakistan, attended University of North Carolina, read and spoke English himself a bit more fluently than Dr. Zawahiri. But most importantly, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed liked to drink scotch, unlike Ayman Zawahiri, and also unlike bin Laden. He was able to move flawlessly and effortlessly through Western culture. As Mao said, a gorilla must move like a fish through water. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was able to do that. His English was passable. He had tastes for Western food and drink. He dressed appropriately. He acted appropriately. He flew first class. And that allowed him to do a lot of things for Al-Qaeda and make a lot of things happen. He was their genius at making things happen.
What you're saying is Osama was just the money bags.
Yeah, he was most effective, I think, when he functioned a lot like a film producer.
Mm-hmm.
He had the money, and he said what he wanted, and he was able to purchase talent and put things in place, which isn't to say that he wasn't an inspiration to his men. The myth of his performance on the battlefield was something that attached itself to him. He was always surrounded by sycophantic people.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Ayman Zawahiri, though, there was a bit more sinister motives than just sycophancy. Dr. Zawahiri always wanted to be in charge. He is now. that he had a great effect on Osama in the end stages of the Soviet jihad and was able to reorient bin Laden's own jihadi goals outward towards the world and was on hand to see that al-Qaeda was a force that wasn't going to engage the West and not merely the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people out there who don't buy the government's official version of what happened on 9/11. There are, I think, something like 1,000 or 2,000 professional architects and engineers. I don't know if you heard of that group, AE 9/11 Truth. You probably did. These are architects who are saying it's basically impossible for fire alone to bring down steel frame buildings. There are people who say that al-Qaeda was a creation not of Osama bin Laden, but of spy organizations, CIA or the Mossad. There are people who say that they've never seen a photograph of the plane going into the Pentagon. There are people who say that the official 9/11 Commission report excluded many things, including the explosions that were heard by the first responders in there. There are people who contend that the Twin Towers were brought down by controlled demolition, that Larry Silverstein ordered Building 7 to be pulled, which he said in the documentary. So there are a lot of holes in the official government conspiracy theory. It can be called a conspiracy theory. In the book, it seems like, however, you feel that whatever the government had said as far as 9/11 is accurate. Am I reading that wrong, or do you have doubts about the government's official conspiracy theory about 9/11?
No, I have no doubt in the phenomena that hijacked airliners were flown into the towers, and the towers collapsed as a result of that. I don't have any doubt that a hijacked airliner struck the Pentagon. I have no doubt that a hijacked airliner crashed in Pennsylvania after a struggle between the passengers and the hijackers. I don't doubt any of that. I've read the 9/11 report closely. I know that there are holes in it. I know that the document is sometimes self-serving. There are some things that the government finds embarrassing. That is that a national security estimate predicted not only that the hijacked aircraft would be used as weapons, but actually named al-Qaeda as the perpetrator. That happened years before the 9/11 attack. The government failed to take adequate measures. I'll remind the readers that during the Clinton administration, someone crashed an airplane right into the White House. These things are forgotten. During the 80s and 90s, I was a member of SEAL Team 6. Part of our exercises, I myself parachuted from jet airliners in exercises that proved that the airliners could be hijacked and crashed by remote control using its autopilot by people who didn't even want to die with the airplane. So it's embarrassing for the government that there were many, many indicators that airliners were a vulnerability, and yet this wasn't addressed. I wrote an article in the Counterterrorist Journal a couple years ago that discusses the Air France hijack, how that aircraft had to be shadowed by French fighters, that the goal of that aircraft was originally to crash into a Paris landmark. These things are embarrassing for the government. But I don't have any doubt that al-Qaeda was behind the 9/11 attacks. You know, I am not a trained architect, but I am a trained demolitionist. It would take literally hundreds of thousands of man hours to have rigged those buildings to collapse. Again, I'm not a structural engineer, but I saw these aircraft crash on live television. Thousands and thousands of people looked up from the streets of Manhattan and saw this happen with their own eyes. That two transcontinental aircraft fully loaded with fuel caused these two buildings to pancake doesn't surprise me. That the film is not available to show the Pentagon being struck by an aircraft, well, I know that the tapes from that strike, the security tapes, are in the possession of the FBI. They haven't been released because they are inflammatory. So, you know, as far as the conspiracy theory goes, you know, I'm happy to listen to anyone who can convince me that somehow hundreds of thousands of man hours were put into the Twin Towers to bring them down in a controlled demolition. And then I'd ask them, what was to be gained by that? A $4 a gallon gasoline? I don't understand why anyone would do that. The other thing I would say to people who say there's a conspiracy, I am proud to have operated at some of the highest levels in the covert forces of the United States government. I find it a bit insulting that any American citizen would think that we at an organization like SEAL Team 6 would have anything to do with something like that. that we somehow, for some reason, for money or some twisted ideology, would operate against our own country. And it seems unfathomable to me that you would think somehow that a SEAL would go from serving overseas in Iraq or Afghanistan or some far-flung places around the world, risking their lives on a daily basis, and then come back and pull an operation off against what? New York? Washington? The Pentagon? That's when the conspiracy theory stuff all falls apart. Who did they get to do it? Did they put an ad in Soldier Fortune magazine and find what? There was this vulnerability there. It'll never happen again in the history of the United States that someone will hijack an aircraft that has American passengers on it. It won't happen anymore. In the hijackings previous to 9/11, there was a social contract between the hijackers and the hijackees, and that was you sit down and cooperate, and we're going to safely land this plane somewhere else, and you will be ransom traded, whatever we make our decisions here. No American passengers are going to let themselves get hijacked again. They will rise and resist. And I'll point out, 25% of al-Qaeda's plot failed. The passengers in that Pennsylvania aircraft realized what was going on, and they rose and fought to take it back. So at least as far as American airliners go, it's over. I think that it's likely even that a European passenger base would rise against the hijackers. And it's likely that these days the passengers realize that they're probably going to be killed anyway, and they'll rise. What unfortunately could be on the horizon is another 9/11-like event. You've got Ayman Zawahiri in charge of al-Qaeda now. He is looking at the fact that his organization is becoming increasingly less relevant in a world that's seen the Arab Spring. And he and his organization are just one spectacular terrorist act away from becoming relevant again. And that is what they plan. That is what they want. That is what they desire. It's a question of preventing them operationally from carrying that out. But they're determined to do so. That fight's not over.
I just want to go back to a couple of things you said. The plane at the Pentagon, you said that the FBI had, I guess, confiscated all of the security tape around the Pentagon, and they're not releasing it, you said, because, did you say inflammatory?
Yes, you know, it's a bit morbid. Those tapes exist. I have not seen them. I have known that people have referred to them. You know, one of the myths is there was nothing found of that aircraft that hit the Pentagon. Well, unfortunately, almost all of it was found. In pieces the size of your little finger. And again, there are eyewitnesses on the ground who saw it with their own eyes. When something this staggering and this terrible happens, it's almost impossible for people to comprehend and understand. And it's very easy and almost necessary to think that some larger hand must have caused it, some grander plan than just 21 religious fanatics armed with box cutters. It's hard to believe that an unemployed actor killed Abraham Lincoln. It's very hard for people to understand that little despicable people can cause unbelievable events. But it's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was actually a Pentagon employee who was there that morning, and she walked out of the hole that was created by the explosion. And she had commented that she had not seen any aircraft parts. And there's people in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, who claim that there were no parts in that crash site.
From what I understand, there were quite a few pieces. There were great numbers of parts recovered from both aircraft. You know what? This is a parallel situation, but I personally inspected what was left of the battalion landing team headquarters in Beirut. That explosion, as we mentioned earlier, was the largest non-nuclear explosion in the history of warfare. Yet a lot of the truck itself survived. The FBI was able to identify where the truck came from, its make and model. I personally recovered items such as water pumps and crankshafts out of that hole, which still had serial numbers on them. Now, that is an explosion that vaporized a four-story building. So, again, some of these things are myths. You can't make a 200-foot airliner disappear. They don't disappear. And those parts were recovered, things like turbine blades, parts of the airframe, etc. In every one of these cases, the crashes were catastrophic, and these aircraft were at almost maximum fuel states. So they were largely destroyed, but nothing is ever completely destroyed.
So your advice to people who doubt the official government story about 9/11 is stop doubting?
I think it's always good to be skeptical of your government, but it was filmed from dozens of angles on live television. I think you'd probably be more credible to doubt the moon landing than 9/11. But there are just a couple of key things, I would say. Then, what part of the American government and what sort of serving man or woman who serves in the military or the intelligence services, what sort of person do you think would be party to turning that against their own nation? I approach this a little differently than some 9/11 doubters. I take it personally. Do you think someone at SEAL Team 6 would have anything to do with this? And then I like to say to the 9/11 doubters, so what was it that was gained by this? What happened? How did the world change? If you look at where we are now, 10 years later, to be honest with you, the world isn't very much different than it was then, except that a lot of illusions are shattered. I don't see what is gained. If you make extraordinary claims, you have to have extraordinary proof.
Yeah, I think that the major argument is that neocons, pro-Israel neocons, had seized control of key areas of the U.S. military-industrial complex. And through their think tanks, they had produced a document, specifically one main document from the Project for the New American Century, claiming that what's needed is a new Pearl Harbor in order to reshuffle the world map, specifically in the Middle East area, and with the prime objective of making sure that Israel's interests were protected. So there are documents, and there are, as far as what I can see, credible arguments, and you could piece this together and understand their arguments. I personally, from reading as much as I do and paying attention to as much as I do, I have doubts about the official government story. And then especially with how you explained on many pages, 44, 71, 73, 72, 163, 184, about the incompetence of, and you mentioned it before, government of the CIA. So especially the CIA. I guess your main beef is with the CIA. So how could an organization as incompetent as the CIA, how could Americans expect that this organization could actually protect them?
I will sustain that comment. But I would also say, how could an organization that inept carry out an act like this? And the other thing is, there are literally no secrets in the world, and nothing can be kept secret for long. I just don't see that it could possibly happen that way. I don't see how the borders in the Middle East would be affected by a Pearl Harbor-like 9/11 event. They weren't in the decades since. And the winds of change that are blowing through the Middle East right now are from a wholly unanticipated direction. Nobody 10 years ago was predicting that social media would be the prime mover in Middle Eastern politics right now. No one, certainly not I, could predict that Hosni Mubarak's combination military dictatorship and Chicago democratic machine would be overthrown by demonstrators connected by cell phones and Twitter. Nobody could have foreseen that. The same with Syria. The interesting thing to me, though, I don't consider that the Middle East is stable. I see it on the edge of a great seismic shift. The unrest that is going on in Syria right now, it is quite a bit more dangerous, I think, than anyone realizes. Syria itself possesses radiological weapons, they possess biological weapons, and they possess chemical weapons. There are fissure lines within Syria that did not exist in Algeria or Egypt. In Syria, an Alawite minority controls most of the means of production, the military, and the intelligence services. And they are vested physically in making sure that Bashar Assad survives, because after him comes the deluge. And it's very likely that the Alawite minority will be the victim of a pogrom should he be overthrown. I think it's likely that he will be overthrown. And I think that when a critical mass is met by the what are now demonstrators, when they are sufficiently armed or reach a tipping point with their arms, I think that there's very likely to be a civil war in Syria unless steps are taken now to ease Bashar Assad out and give him a place to exit. I think it's also in the best interest of everyone in the Middle East, but especially the Israelis, to keep this transition as calm as possible and to not give the Iranians an excuse to intervene militarily into Syria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Israelis probably aren't too happy with what's happening in Egypt right now.
I don't think that the Egyptians want to take on the Israelis again. I don't think the Egyptian military wants to do that, regardless of what sort of propaganda may in the future be fed to the Egyptian people that they desire war with the Israelis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that kind of goes along with your argument that if 9/11 was done to benefit the Israelis, look at what's happening in Egypt with the Islamists.
Yeah, I just don't see how it benefited Israel by any stretch of the imagination. The United States intervened, in my opinion, unwisely in Iraq. It intervened unwisely in Afghanistan. Take Afghanistan for a second. We went ahead and invaded Afghanistan, despite the fact that Alexander the Great never conquered it.
Right.
The British at the height of empire never conquered it. The Soviet Union never conquered it. It's never been conquered in 1,500 years of recorded history, and now we're in the process of pulling out. The British in World War I invaded Iraq, where they lost 40,000 people trying to get from Basra to Baghdad. 40,000 troops. What was to be gained from either one of those interventions? Again, no one here at the pointy end was thinking, what are you going to do in Iraq? Are you going to somehow create the first functional democracy in the history of the Arab world? The one almost exception proves the point. Lebanon has some sort of parliamentary system, but Lebanon's a basket case. And right now, Lebanon is under the heel of Hezbollah, which is armed and trained by the Iranians. And Hezbollah, uniquely for a non-nation state, is in possession of cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. And I think that is the point of danger for both the nation of Israel and us all. The fact that non-nation states are in possession of state-of-the-art weapons. These things are not under the control of any government at all, but in the control of a mullah.
Right. And you had brought up before the weapons that Syria has, and a major part of your book are the WMDs, that you say that the U.S. media, they had their story, there are no WMDs, but there is actually a lot of evidence that weapons of mass destruction have been discovered in Iraq, aren't there?
Yes. All one needs to do is go through the United Nations website and type in weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and you will be led to almost a dozen technical reports authored by the United Nations, some with unambiguous titles, such as Weapons of Mass Destruction Discovered in Iraq Since 2007. Now, there are some people who have said these weapons are old. The fact is that nobody thinks that Saddam Hussein put himself at the service of world peace, secretly disposed of his chemical weapons in an environmentally friendly way, complied with the United States, then why was he invaded? The fact is that there have been hundreds and hundreds of chemical weapons discovered in Iraq. Any one of them could wind up here in the United States. In 2004, at Al Bayah, outside the Baghdad airport, a VX nerve gas shell was set as a roadside bomb. It was disrupted by bomb technicians who didn't realize at first it was a chemical shell. They were contaminated with nerve gas. This was reported by the BBC, by the New York Times, by all the cable news outlets. An article appeared in the Journal of Military Medicine describing the exposure of these two guys to nerve gas. This was the first time in the history of war that a weapon of mass destruction had been used on the battlefield by a non-state actor. It changed the world. But nobody noticed. Nobody stopped to pause and think. Now, these weapons were in the control of Al-Qaeda. Months later, there was a big scare about chemical weapons in Amman, Jordan. It lit very briefly on the media radar, and they forgot about it as well. Even perusing the WikiLeaks documents, one can see the existence of an army unit called Technical Escort. It deals exclusively with chemical, nuclear, and biological threats. Why is that unit deployed to Iraq? Why has that unit been deployed to Afghanistan? Because there are chemical weapons that have been recovered there. These were weapons of Iraqi prominence, and they've come into the possession of Al-Qaeda. Now, Dr. Zawahiri has frequently stated his desire to use these weapons against the West. That is a threat that still exists. The fact that it's an inconvenient fact for the media, who were heavily invested in the narrative of an unjustifiable war, I simply ask them to explain away the United Nations reports or the National Intelligence Estimate letter written by the Director of National Intelligence, John Negroponte, to the head of the Senate Committee on Intelligence, stating categorically that weapons had been discovered in Iraq, that they were assessed to still exist, and the threat could not be dismissed that these weapons would wind up in other places in the world through the black market or terrorists. These are memorandum that exist. These are the smoking guns. The media reports what it wants to.
What you're saying is the mainstream media kind of moves in a monolithic manner then. It's
well,
basically,
you know,
is it a conspiracy? I mean, I don't...
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's a conspiracy. It simply comes down to this. If you are selling news programming to advertisers who want to buy commercials on your news program, and you're supposed to be reporting the facts, and if what you've been reporting is wrong, then what value are your advertisers getting from you? I think it's just that simple. If you were to ask a reader of the New York Times, are there any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? They say, no. Bush lied. People died. They don't read the United Nations reports. They don't seem to understand that every year the United States holds a ground-up, top-to-bottom counterterrorism exercise called Top Off. Every year that deals with the threats of weapons of mass destruction.
It seems mind-numbing to me that this mainstream media organization, organ, entity, does this. They don't report the truth. They keep it hidden for the sake of making money off their advertisers.
There are some people who report the facts. The great thing about the information age, and one of the great things about our democracy and our culture, is that the facts are available. You can come to the facts and make your own decisions. But if the only means by which you discover the facts are network news programs, then I don't think you're going to get to the truth.
Right.
I don't think you're going to get to the truth.
I want to talk about Osama bin Laden. Again, there's a lot of folks out there who believe that he died in December of 2001 from kidney failure. I know you talked about Addison's disease and a couple other things, but from your research, did he have something wrong with his kidneys?
As far as I could tell, he did not have renal failure beyond what might have been incidental to Addison's disease. The sort of story of his kidney failure came out. There was no dialysis machinery recovered at the site. As far as I am aware, during his autopsy, he had elevated cortisol levels. This was consistent with Addison's disease. His symptomology, low back pain, fainting, low blood pressure, craving for table salt, all consistent with Addison's disease. And you know what? He was in the kind of shape you'd expect for a 54-year-old man who'd lived a pretty hard life. As far as his being dead in 2001, you know what, for all intents and purposes, when he moved into that Abbottabad compound, he was dead. His world constricted down to that little triangle, and he paced in it and became increasingly irrelevant. He had pulled over and allowed Daman Zawahiri to exert increasing influence in al-Qaeda. During the 10 years that he was in hiding, he communicated only by messenger, by letter, no electronic means in and out of that compound. During those 10 years, Zawahiri, always with the eye on the main prize, in the last 6 months before the raid, you have to remember, Dr. Zawahiri could read and speak English. He watched the news. He read books about al-Qaeda, read books about himself, wrote books, was much more connected into the outside world, I think, than bin Laden was able to do because he could speak English. Now, Zawahiri can read in books that al-Kuwaiti had been outed as a courier, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had mentioned him in interrogations in Gitmo. It's unfathomable, but Dr. Zawahiri continued to use al-Kuwaiti as a courier. Not only did he continue to use him, he bought him a brand new white Toyota truck with a rhinoceros painted on it and had him continue to be the final leg of communication into and out of the compound.
Right.
And that act of omission, which I don't think it was omission, that deliberate act was what tipped off the United States. And eventually the Americans found bin Laden. How could they not? So now you can see this American raid as the culmination of a power struggle within al-Qaeda that a very ambitious man, Dr. Zawahiri, who again was a physician trained at one of the best Middle Eastern medical schools, consistently failed to diagnose Addison's disease in his patient, consistently failed to treat him, pushed him forward into combat with the Soviets, did everything he could to have him killed, and then finally tipped off the Americans to where he was, and the Americans did the job for him.
Right.
I think that Dr. Zawahiri, as these facts emerge and come forward, I think he's going to have some trouble exerting leadership within al-Qaeda. When a sufficient number of al-Qaeda adherents come to see that this negligence or deliberate act on the part of Dr. Zawahiri led to the death of Osama bin Laden, I think you're going to see a power struggle within al-Qaeda. I think you can expect to see its splinter, and Zawahiri will become either isolated or assassinated, and there will be some big changes in al-Qaeda here. I think this will happen within the next 5 to 6 months.
Wow. It's a short time frame. On page 204, you say, and this, of course, is the night of the raid. This was May 1st of last year. The facts are these. During the entire operation, SEAL Team 6 fired only 12 bullets. These shots killed Osama bin Laden, his son, and two bodyguards. All these men were armed or in close proximity to weapons. The wife of Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, you mentioned him before, was killed accidentally. She was standing behind her husband as he exchanged gunfire with a passing helicopter. The operators who entered bin Laden's bedroom did not wait for him to arm himself. They shot first. Amal was grazed by a bullet when the SEALs fired at her husband, who was at the instant concealed behind her nightgown and reaching for an automatic weapon. Bin Laden died with a hand stretched toward a rifle and pistol in plain sight next to his headboard. And then, in accordance with Islamic tradition, Osama was washed, wrapped in clean cloth, and buried at sea as the carrier steamed, and of course that's a USS Carl Vinson, carrier steamed south from the coast of Pakistan. Now, you spoke to, obviously, members of SEAL Team 6. You obviously know these people. Do you have any doubt in your mind that the person they killed was Osama bin Laden?
No doubt whatsoever. No doubt whatsoever. He was identified by a number of forensic means. There is absolutely no doubt in anyone's mind who was killed that night and who was buried off the Carl Vinson.
Do you think we'll ever see the photographs?
I have seen photographs. Those are not the most convincing bits of evidence. He was identified by means of DNA and several other means of identification, all correlated.
But you've seen the photographs of bin Laden?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And can you make out that was him, or you're saying that it's not convincing?
Again, I wouldn't base my entire case on a mere photograph. I'm convinced by a number of means that some of them were contextual. Could this gentleman in this compound, with all this intelligence information surrounding him, with wives that claimed to be his wives and children claimed to be his children, could all of that possibly have been faked, along with genetic data, fingerprints, everything else? No, I don't think it could have been faked.
Now, the fallout of all this was that, as you say on page 205, more confusing was why the White House had said anything at all about SEAL Team 6 being involved. Why do you think it is that the White House spilled the beans about the SEALs, even though the CIA was taking credit for the entire operation?
I think that they had pretty much a train wreck in their information operation. It was Vice President Biden who first mentioned the SEALs. I think before that, it was very unlikely that either JSOC or the SEALs would have ever stated anything about responsibility for the operation. I think that a plan was put into position for Leon Panetta's CIA to assume as much credit as possible for the operation. Part of that, in the very long view, is to redeem themselves for the failure to predict 9/11 or prevent it, along with several, almost half a dozen other grave terrorist incidents around the world, including the coal bombing, the bombing of the African embassies, failure to predict the Pakistani nuclear program, et cetera, et cetera. I do think, unfortunately, there was an effort on the part of the White House to take information regarding the raid, to put it into the hands of certain individuals, i.e. Sony Pictures, in order to make a movie out of this.
Right.
That is an embarrassment to the White House itself, I'm afraid. It does take away and diminish, though I think a little, but I will say that I think that President Obama is underrated as a commander-in-chief. I think that this was a fine example of firmness and personal courage on his part, and I think that he has really done a pretty good job fighting the war on terror and pursuing al-Qaeda all over the world. What I don't think was a very good job was by people who work for him after this raid, who did their best to leak information to make themselves look better. I don't think everything they leaked was even close to the truth, or in some cases it wasn't even plausible. So I don't think he was very well served by the people under him.
Okay. As we speak, there's a lot going on in the Strait of Hormuz, which you mentioned in this fine book, that was a very important aspect of the Soviet invasion, and that's a very important aspect of what's going on now. Are there SEAL teams out there right now, you think?
I would say if you're a bad guy, wherever the sun goes down,
right,
there are SEALs. If it's dark outside, we're there too.
Chuck, let me just say, it was a great book. Chuck, if somebody wanted to pick up your book, I know you have a website, chuckfarrer.com. That's chuckfarrer.com. And I would imagine that they could get the book on your site. Is that right?
They can. It's pretty much everywhere. I would say this. If I have to be in your town doing a book signing, come on out, because every time we do a book signing, every penny of the proceeds go to a warrior foundation or to one of the SEAL Team charities. So come on out and say hi. I'll be delighted to sign a book for you.
Sounds great, Chuck. The Inside Story of the Mission to Kill Osama bin Laden, SEAL Target Geronimo by Chuck Farrer, author of Warrior Soul, the memoir of a Navy SEAL, and many other things. Chuck, I want to thank you so much for the time you took explaining all this to the listeners, and looking forward to your next book.
Listen, thanks very much. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope to be talking to you again.